Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing, and this is episode 192. And I'm very excited to bring to you this week Nancy Carbone. Now, following the events of 9/11, Nancy realized that there was going to be a huge need for the responders, whether it was the mental trauma that they'd seen, whether it was just the fact of trying to find the brotherhood amongst that. Some of these firehouses are being completely wiped out. So she founded Friends of Firefighters, and you're going to hear the events of 9/11, the birth of this amazing organization, and then all the incredible things that they've done for the men and women that responded. But not only for that day, but just the factors that affect us through their careers. So some of these men and women had 30 years on before 9/11. Some of them weren't even there for 9/11. And Friends of Firefighters are still for those new men and women that are responding now to event after event. So a very powerful story. But like I always say before we start the interview, please go to your podcast app, whether it's iTunes, Stitcher, whatever you use, and subscribe to the show. Rate the show. The more ratings we get, the more visible we are to other people looking for this kind of project. And then most importantly, use your social media and share these episodes. There are men and women out there right now that need to listen to some of these incredible guests that literally will change their lives. So with that being said, I introduce to you Nancy Carbone. Enjoy. Nancy, I want to start by saying thank you so much. I know John Walters reached out to you for me, and he told me a lot about what you guys have going on there. And the moment I heard that, I knew we needed to get you on the podcast. So firstly, thank you for saying yes.
Thank you. Thank you for asking.
And where are we finding you today?
Physically or mentally?
I have to clarify. I get that a lot. Yeah.
So I'm upstate New York. I'm actually working from home today because it's a little hard to concentrate. We work in an old firehouse and it's sometimes quite busy. So I came up to do some work and have this conversation in quiet.
Okay. So. And how far upstate? Because I used to work up in the Adirondacks for years.
Oh, yeah. I'm in the Catskills.
Okay.
Beautiful. Yeah, not quite as far as the Adirondacks.
No, that's quite a hike. Mm-hmm. All right. So then just to give some backstory on yourself, where were you born and what was your family unit? What did your parents do and how many siblings?
Oh, wow. I didn't expect that, but luckily I know the answers. I was born in Flushing, New York and moved out to Long Island where I was raised. I have six siblings. My father was a custodial engineer and my mom was stay at home for many years and then she got into the medical field.
Okay, so did you have any first responders in your extended family at all?
My mom's uncle was killed line of duty, and another uncle was a police officer, but beyond that, no.
Gotcha. Okay, and then when you were young, what were your career aspirations then?
Oh, when I was younger, what did I want? Well, I was a singer for a number of years, and I also, I was very interested in the medical field. I actually wanted to be a doctor at one point. And I ended up doing doula work. So I was doing postpartum home care, actually labor and delivery and postpartum home care with new mothers and new families. And I was particularly drawn to the families where the infant did not survive. So I would help them through the process. And to be honest, the process, no matter how many years have spanned since then, I'm sure the process continues for each of those families.
Yeah. So you were introduced to psychological trauma at quite an early age then.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And just to, as a total tangent, you see now it's a lot more visible that people are, getting to spend time with their infant, even though they've been born stillbirth or, you know, whatever the consequences are. Is that something you think is a good coping mechanism for those mothers and fathers?
Well, you know, a coping mechanism for losing an infant, I'll tell you, I don't know. I do know that that is a significant change from how it used to be. They used to just remove the fetus or infant and unceremoniously dump it. So it was not, there wasn't much sensitivity around it. In fact, I think there was the feeling that the less said, the better. And they have come a long way with handling infant death. But at the same time, it's quite a mark on your life that never leaves. So, the photographs, the time with the infant, the ability to have a memory of like a hair clipping, those things are small comforts, but they're better than what they had years ago.
Absolutely. It's interesting the parallel between what you just told us about how they used to deal with losing a child and how we as a profession dealt with the trauma we saw for years, which was to bury it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, burying it. We're all really good at burying things and then wonder why we spill over into insignificant events that turn into possibly disasters because we overreact, not putting two and two together.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, speaking of disasters, I think really the anchor of this interview is going to be 9/11. So if you want to kind of walk us through your personal experience of that specific event, and then we'll continue into how you decided to help.
Well, I first want to say that I am in no means any kind of an expert. And when I talk about 9/11, I can only give you my own personal perspective. I wouldn't dare to give someone else's, nor, start to cite different facts and statistics. However, living there when it happened and being on the ground in the first days and then the years to follow, I have a perspective that I think is unique in that I think what I witnessed right away, first of all, the first thing we did as New Yorkers is if we have children, we went and got the children out of school. And I had a son in college in Vermont at the time, and my daughter was in high school across the water where they were able to see, the towers fall from her school. And I ran up to get her. So that was the first thing, is to make sure that my child was with me. And my son couldn't reach me for 2 or 3 days, which was another difficulty for him down the road. At the time, really, we were just trying. We were very hungry for information. We had no idea what had happened. We knew it was a terrorist attack when the second plane hit. And I had 5 friends who were firefighters at the time. And of course, I worried about whether or not they had survived. The initial numbers that came out was that the FDNY lost 500 plus members. And so what's such a staggering number, we couldn't really get our minds around the numbers that were flying around. We were told that over 25,000 people were probably killed. And then, of course, that any number is too many, but the number was significantly less. But and I think due to the first responders, both fire and police and other workers in the city, that it helped. But as a civilian, I wanted to help like everyone else. And I'm not quite sure to this day what made me walk past several firehouses to one that was 2, maybe 3 neighborhoods away. But I walked to a firehouse and found after I had gotten there that they lost 8 members. But they didn't know that they were lost yet. It was all very new. It was the next day. And I ran into a firefighter, John Sorrentino, and at Engine 205. And they're at the base of the Brooklyn Bridge. And he asked for 3 things. The first thing he said is, we're going to need bunting for our house. Now, remember, this is when most people were saying, our guys are coming back. They're just lost, in the confusion, but they'll be coming back. He saw right away that he felt strongly that his members would not be coming back, that they had been killed. And then he said, we need bunting for the firehouse. We need a bugler for the funerals. And we're going to need counseling. So when I think of all of those things in hindsight, 18 years later, it's staggering to me because, first of all, to have that kind of an awareness that the finality of it for that firehouse, that their members were not coming back, really that was the first person I met. And he was the first person I met, but he was also the first one for a long time that said, this is the way it's going to be. And I recognize that there's going to be significant deaths and we might as well plan for this. The thing that really blew me away was the request for counseling. Historically, first responders do not say they need help. It's very difficult for them to say they need help. They are the people that we go to for help. So it's a turn of events that would cause him to say such a thing, but it was really, to me, very impressive. And also a daunting responsibility, because I felt that anyone I would bring to this firehouse, where I didn't know the members yet, that would be a therapist, that could be potentially a dangerous thing. So I really actually only helped them get the bunting and the bugler. And then I was, over time, we grew to be friends, many of the members in the house and myself. And by Christmas, I was actually organizing the community to be able to give the members what they were asking for, which at the time were socks, shoes, things that they needed at the site, long johns, things that, you know, the socks and shoes were really melting. You know, they were people, I don't think, realized that the site was quite dangerous. It was burning into December. So they needed supplies. And we actually grew to be friends. I based what I thought was just a friendship actually at the time, and it does continue to this day with the members. But I was out of that firehouse 118 and 205. They lost 8 members that day. And then I started to reach out to other firehouses where the members of 205 and 118 recognized the need for houses in industrial areas, firehouses, to have items that they couldn't get because they were in areas that didn't have neighbors. 118 had neighbors. So I started distributing to my friend's firehouse up in the Bronx, and then grew from there. And all the while not realizing that the trust was building and they were relying on me for some things. And I took it very seriously. By, I would say, October, I had some friends that were joining me and helping. And then I had complete strangers from the neighborhood that were helping. And we were not a nonprofit, actually, until February. But right around Christmas time, 01, I was asked to build a counseling center for firefighters that would be separate from the fire department, so that they felt that there would be no trail on their record, on their employee records. At the time, I didn't understand fully why they couldn't go to counseling services unit, which is called CSU. And I have come to learn that they're an excellent unit. But if there's a perception that a firefighter has that they're going to go to the job for help and it's going to stay on their record, that might prevent him or her from getting the counseling. So with that request, I went out and I started to look for counselors. And I started to look for a site in which to build. Not a center. I really thought we were going to have something for about a year. So a friend in the neighborhood, Elizabeth O'Connell, became the first board chair of our nonprofit. And she had some real estate and offered us a shop that used to be a shop for plastic flowers. And we went in, and the firefighters actually came from what was called Ground Zero at the time, which by this time was the pit. And then it was the pile first, and then it was the pit. And they would come over and build out this long storefront so that it had a counseling room in the front, or rather in the middle, and then a little kitchen in the back. And I started to interview counselors, and I thought that was one of the more difficult things, because I felt that the counselor had to be understanding. I had witnessed some of the counselors that had gone to the firehouses. Some were terrific and got right in there, and others were really out of the water. They were out of their depth. They came in with clipboards and, you know, they cocked their heads and said, oh, and it just was a bad match. What I did once we incorporated was I partnered with Safe Horizons, which is a group that deals with victims of violence. So that worked for about a year and a half, and then we started getting our own in-house counselors, and we've been that way ever since. We have our own counseling center.
Right. So, and it's an interesting point, because it's something that we're still dealing with now, and that was, you know, 2001 or 2002 technically. And to this day, I mean, I have numerous interviews where some of the men and women telling the stories were, you know, were sent to a counselor through EAP, for example, and the counselor was in tears. And you had, yes. again, like yes. you said, completely out of their depth, had no yes. no connection to this profession whatsoever, and it made it worse. And some of them were like, well, there you go. Counseling's, you know, clearly pointless then. I may as well just go and take my own life or whatever was on their head. And it's so, so important that they do find these people that know what they've been through, or at least can understand what they've been through.
Well, you know, the idea is to remove all obstacles, right? Because the first responders will put obstacles there themselves. So, for instance, I overheard a firefighter telling the kitchen, the firehouse kitchen, there were probably about 7 or 8 members in the kitchen, that he had tried counseling and it didn't work. So I guess I was just like a little, I wanted to push him a little bit on that and find out what that was about. And again, remember, I'm a guest in their kitchen. So really, it has to be with all due respect. And I just said, could you tell me what happened? And he said, yeah, I went there and I drove around for like 20 minutes and I couldn't find it and I left. I said, but what part of it didn't work? He said, I couldn't find them. So everybody laughed. And I said, but actually, you never got inside a room with a counselor. No, F them, you know. So now, had I not asked him the question, I think all of us would have left the room with, oh my God, he had a terrible experience with counseling. But I'll tell you that it's not okay that they couldn't be easily found. It's not okay that they moved counseling offices around. It's also not the fire department's fault because they had funding initially and then the funding went away. And there are a lot of different demands on them. And remember, they lost 343 members that day of active firefighters. And the demand on a small, I believe they had 11 counselors on 9/11/2001, and they had to expand very quickly. So it was a tremendous effort on their part to fill the needs. So not all of the places that they chose worked out as much as everyone wanted them to. But this firefighter came away with the perception that counseling as a whole, he tried it and it didn't work. That message coming back to the firefighters who may have their hand on the phone to call for help, they'll pull away. So it was important to really get into what didn't work for him. There is a sense that if you go for counseling, that you're considered to be weak. I think in maybe with all first responders. And that's an unfortunate thing because it really takes a lot of strength to pick up the phone, make the call and say, you know, I really need the help.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the difference between what you guys went through in New York and let's say Grenfell, the big fire in London they had a few years ago, they're still going through that right now as far as, you know, the court side and a huge loss of life. But those men and women still got to go back to their fire stations and it was kind of business as normal, you know, as usual, apart from the trauma that they'd actually seen. Once that fire was out, then it was, you know, over to the investigators. So they got to go to normal. But then when I had John Walters on and he was recalling what it was like, you know, the men and women at FDNY were either on the pile, going to a funeral, or still running calls because now they were an entire shift short, basically. So they never even had time to go home to process, to band together and grieve, because those brothers and sisters that they would have grieved with, some of the firehouses were completely empty because every single one was killed.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Hazmat 1 Squad 288 lost 19 members. And it took them really years to get back to full speed. And these are highly qualified firefighters. And you know, there's the scientific part of what they do as well. So they were specialists. And to lose 19 firefighters from one house is devastating. I believe they had over 40 children amongst them. So, you know, the firehouse, of course, wants to step in and help the families as much as they can. And I don't believe that there was a protocol that was written prior to 9/11 about how to help the families. So that's another area that was problematic, which was that the firehouses understood and did exactly. They stepped up and they helped the families. But when you're getting into the numbers of families that they had to help, all the while going to the pile, going to the events, meaning funerals and later plaque dedications and whatnot, They're taking the families down to the morgue, helping them do whatever they could. They lost touch with their own families, many of them. I saw some firefighters would bring their wives and involve them with caring for the family of the fallen brothers. And those marriages actually fared better. But it's, I think, more of a tradition in the fire department that you don't bring home your problems. You don't bring home the job you saw. And you mentioned something about back to normal. There is no normal. You have to create a new normal after a disaster like that, especially when you're missing your brothers. And I think when you go into a massive disaster and your whole goal is to save the people in the disaster, and you referred to, you know, what had happened in England, they come away and they're indelibly changed by it. But when, as you state, you're losing what are oftentimes family members. There are so many firefighters that lost their brothers and fathers and sons. So that's that. But then you're not going home. And home is where your comfort is and your heart is. And if they're not able to go home for weeks at a time, the toll that it takes, both on the first responder and then there's secondary trauma to the family. And those families have been impacted negatively. And you see it even to this day.
Yeah. Now, just to go off on a tangent for a moment, because I'm intrigued. I had Sebastian Junger on here a couple of times, and he wrote a book, Tribe, and he talks about how more for the, obviously, the civilians, the outer perimeter of people that responded after, the initial event, that actually brought New York together. And a lot of the mental health issues that they'd seen in the city prior to that actually lowered incredibly because people had a sense of purpose. Was that something that you saw yourself? I mean, obviously you were walking the walk by doing this, but did you see that amongst your fellow New Yorkers as well?
I'm trying to understand your question fully. Could you restate it? Because two things came to mind, but I'm not quite sure if I was clear on what you were asking.
No problem at all. So I'll be more clear. So one of the observations he made was the tribalism in humans is a very healing thing. And they supposedly observed that the mental health issues that they'd seen amongst some New Yorkers, whatever the statistics were, fell incredibly after 9/11 happened because people banded together and that sense of purpose was almost healing amongst the people of New York.
Oh, yeah. All right. And so you're talking about civilians now as opposed to first responders. I think that there is something to that. I think there was a respect that hadn't been shown before for the first time. You really didn't hear car horns honking. You didn't have the snippiness on the line at the store. Strangers were asking each other, are your people okay? Are you okay? Is your family okay? I myself asked and was asked, is everybody okay on your side? With just passing someone in the street. So there was that for some time. I thoroughly enjoyed the absence of reality shows during that time. So somebody had the common sense to remove most of those awful channels, which all came back, of course, with a vengeance. But yeah, we had been attacked, and even people on opposite ends, they come together when they're attacked, and I think that did strengthen New York, certainly, maybe the country for a period of time. Of course, it's divisive now, but at the time, I do believe that there was a sense of purpose and a sense of compassion, and there was empathy. And I found it very upsetting personally. I didn't cry when the firefighters told me some very upsetting things. But what did choke me up every single time was when I saw people from outside the city coming forward and doing so much to help. That always touched me.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. It resonated around the world, but we all felt very helpless. I was in Japan at the time, so you wanted to do something, but it was hard geographically to be able to help. And I walked the World Trade Center with a wounded Marine last year. Actually, should be coming again this year. And he climbed it with no legs. It's absolutely incredible. But again, it's just a small token to show the men and women of FDNY and you know, the Port Authority and everyone else that was involved, that we cared then and we still care now.
Yeah, and I think there is a sense, when you do that, first of all, I thank you, but it's a validation, because without that, there is the sense, well, I walked, not me, but the firefighter might say, I walked through hell, and not that they want any credit for it, but just to remember that, and especially with all the deaths and the continued deaths from 9/11 illnesses, it's but it is comforting, I guess is the word, to know that it was, it's still remembered.
Yeah. So when did you officially become Friends of Firefighters?
Well, it's so funny because the name was such that held me back, because I really hated the name, but I couldn't think of any other name. And what's odd is that it's really I always considered myself to be second to the firefighters, that they ran it and that I just listened to what they had to say, and then I implemented what I could. And now our staff is just phenomenal. But we incorporated in February of 2002, and we got our first place in March of 2002, and we got our second place in 2005, and we were operating two locations that were four buildings away from each other, but there was so much lead paint we couldn't communicate. We had to go out in the streets and talk to each other or make a phone call. But there was no computer, nothing. It was really very grassroots. Initially, we had paint cans for seats, and it took us a while. And we didn't have a paid staff until, I guess, 2005, I think. It might have been 2005. And again, I went into this thinking it was going to be a year, maybe. And then, okay, well, it's two. And then there was a fire. I think the first fire that I recall, the first firefighter fatality post 9/11 that I recall, was Tommy Brick at the mattress fire in the Bronx. And that brought home to me that there were firefighters that came on after 9/11 that would need support going forward for their trauma, because the Brick fire, the Bronx fire, we lost the fires, the firefighters in the Bronx, and then Richie was killed the same day in Brooklyn. That was their 9/11. That was their horror. And so I thought, all right, well, maybe we should stay around for 5 years. I think it was at the 10-year mark that I realized that it's going to stay around, hopefully much longer than I, if I can raise enough money to do so, because it's so necessary. There are firefighters that come in, and we're seeing, I think primarily the 50% of the firefighters that come in, they come in for relational conflicts. The secondary reason is anxiety. And number three is depression. So we're seeing tremendous post-traumatic stress, OCD. And there are people in treatment now that have been in treatment for some time. We don't limit the numbers of visits that they can have, nor do we put any barriers up that might prohibit their, you know, involvement in therapy. So that is really important to us, how we run it. But back then, it was real seat of the pants. It was really just, okay, let's get through another day. It was going to a lot of the funerals. And I think a lot of it also was building trust, which I didn't realize I was doing at the time. I just was trying to help who became friends. I was trying to help. And I don't do any of the really important work that's done in counseling in the room, and I don't do that.
Right. And then let's talk about the building that you're in now, because I think that's mm-hmm. very important why you made that choice.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it was funny because right around 2008 or 9, I recognized that if we didn't move into a firehouse, we would have to close. And it was just my gut that told me that, you know, we were going to lose the firefighters that really didn't want to go to a little flower shop and you know, and have counseling. It was also, there were a lot of things culminating at the time. There was road work going on. There was no parking. And here came some obstacles, you know, that I didn't want anyone to say I traveled around the block 10 times and couldn't park. So I was having a meeting, and at the time we had a therapist in the office. She came out of the office, and she overheard me talking to several members of a particular firehouse about wanting to get into a firehouse. And she said, you know, there's a vacant one on in this, on the next street over. And I know that the tenant is planning to skip out on the rent and disappear. So that was odd because I didn't want to rat him out, but at the same time, I wanted to get in there. And the owner of that building was the husband of the woman who owned the building we were in at the time, Elizabeth O'Connell. Her husband, Greg, owns the firehouse. And so we went in, and over 400 firefighters in New York City built, it was a metal fabrication shop. It was initially a firehouse built in 1871. By the time we moved in 2009, it had many, many different lives. It was a chop shop, a wholesale fish store, and then it was a metal fabrication shop. And the firefighters came in and returned it to a firehouse. So it is very much like it was. There's a kitchen downstairs, though, and one upstairs. The one downstairs is for the peers, the firefighters, to talk with firefighters. And then we also have a huge apparatus floor for educational purposes and events. And then upstairs are the offices. And we had to move there because we see it in the firefighters' eyes when they walk in, and they feel at home right away, that they can go into the kitchen and it's just like being in their firehouse kitchen. I think it's more significant for the retirees who feel disconnected. And if you think, you know, it's not a typical job. It's not like when you go into any other job and you punch a clock and you like some people, you don't like other people, but you all get that widget made at the end of the day and it gets sold or whatever. This is a job where you face death on a daily basis. Every tour, you may not come back. So there's a bond there. And if you don't like a guy, you don't like a guy, but you know that that person's going to have your back in a fire. So the bonds that are forged over years, when the firefighters retire, they lose that. And they can come back to the firehouse and someone could answer the door. And this has happened many times. And the person at the door says, "Yes, sir, how can I help you?" And that particular firefighter did 30 years in the house. So that's a gut punch. When they come to our place, more often than not, they know somebody that's working there. They know somebody that's there volunteering. And they're at home. And the downstairs and the ability to be welcomed and understood is, I think, priceless.
Yeah. And I've had a few conversations with firemen recently about this exact thing, which is, you know, I always kind of dreaded that. I'm like, how do you spend 30 years as a firefighter and then one day empty your locker and just walk away and the bay door closes behind you and that's it? And I mean, that's got to be so traumatic in a way. And you get the guys and, you know, they're counting down the days and all that stuff, but that was a part of who they were. It should never be all of who you are. That's very unhealthy, I think. But to have that connection back to where you work, whether you visit and you help training, or, you know, you have a group that gets together of retirees that does some sort of work with the current department, or in this case, what a great opportunity for retirees to be involved helping the younger generation now, but still being, you know, still having their finger on the pulse themselves.
Yeah. It's, you know, I don't know how. I don't know many firefighters that count the days till they retire. In fact, I probably think there's like a handful of them. Firefighters generally, they are eager to do more than 20 years. Maybe not so much today, but certainly when I started this, they wanted to do 30 or more. One of the key people that works with us, and in fact, he's my guy. He's the one that guides me and has since day one, is Tony Catapano. Tony had 42 plus years in Engine 202. And when he lays it down, it stays down. He knows the job. He knows the firefighters. And he has a moral compass like no other. So he is the one that really, in the end, has final say as to how Friends of Firefighters operates, as it relates to the firefighters themselves. In regards to grants and all the outside world things and dealing with the department, you know, he'll advise, but he doesn't. He really keeps the environment at Friends of Firefighters comfortable and familiar, so that the firefighters walking through the door, they see Tony Catt, they light up, and they just, you know, they feel like they're home.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. And I think that
he's like a treasure.
Yeah. And an area that we touched on a second ago that I think is so important is obviously 9/11 happened. So you think, oh, FDNY, there are all these issues because of 9/11. But, you know, 9/10, the men that had been on the job for X amount of time had 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years of progressive cumulative cause, sleep deprivation, you know.
Yes.
And I think that's an area that we're now starting to understand, is you can be in a department that's never had a catastrophic event and still have the cancers, the PTSD, all these things that we're seeing. And it's definitely, there's no question in my mind that it's the calls and also, you know, the shifts as well. I mean, that's not natural for the human body to go through that.
Well, it's not natural, but nothing about firefighting is natural, and it doesn't make sense either. I think it's important to state that while I have said the men, it was only as it relates to losing 343 male firefighters on that day. But the men and women of the department, and I know that you know this, are equally affected by certently the repeated tragedies. So, I mean, if you go back a little bit, there were many fires. There's the Walbaum's fire, where there's a tremendous loss of life. There's a 23rd Street fire, a tremendous loss of life for firefighters. This is line of duty deaths. And then there was a telephone fire, where the firefighters that responded to that had an inordinate experience. Post-fire, they had cancers. They were dying of cancer. And to the degree where everyone that had responded to that fire had a special note put on their files because they realized that this person had been exposed. So there has been a cause and effect with cancer before, prior to 9/11. But 9/11, we're no longer talking about 100-plus firefighters. We're talking about 10,000. And not just FDNY. Obviously, there's police and all the other first responders, the steel workers, you know, anybody that had anything to do down at the site, and then people that came from outside of New York City, and there were many that came to help. So this really does it starts there, but it branches out actually across the country. I'm sure there are firefighters with 9/11 cancer in California.
Yeah, that came to help. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what are the trends? I know we talked about the funding, and I mean, we're not going to get into the politics of that, but what are the trends of, you know, the rates of cancer that you're seeing now, and what is in place to help those men and women?
Well, you know, they have the World Trade Center, the registry, and they keep track of everything that's gone on. And I think, you know, I wanted to see, I called health services before to just double check, and our statistics do match, where just until December of last year, 156 firefighters died, and they could attribute 119 to cancer. The suicides are much, much harder to track, because in many ways, suicides are still the fact that it's a suicide is kind of buried. It's not something that really gets out beyond that firehouse, if possible. But I think that it needs to, because it's no longer the shame of the family that this happened. It is actually important for other firefighters to see that this has been happening. But it's also important so that the funding is made available for suicide prevention for first responders. And that's something that I don't think is spoken about a lot, although it is getting a lot more of a spotlight. It really needs to be addressed. And I know that the International Association of Firefighters and the unions, both in New York and elsewhere, are looking at this as a critical concern. You know, the depression, and, you know, when you're looking at, if we're saying that we have relational conflict, that's what we're seeing, anxiety and depression and tremendous post-traumatic stress. Where do they go if they don't go for help? And where do they go if there's repeated tragedies? We had Hurricane Sandy in 2012, and 700 plus active firefighters and over 1,200 retirees, many of them sick, lost their homes or had significant damage to their homes. And so now, what do you do with the firefighter that was at 9/11, did lose people from the firehouse? They're possibly struggling with their own health issues, and then they lose their homes. Now their family's imperiled. You know, a lot of those homes were flooded and they went on fire, certainly in Breezy Point and in different sections of Rockaway, Staten Island, and different areas in New York, where they now are homeless. They're in a hotel and they're staying there, and they've got to go through the daunting, I don't even know the word for it. It's really just an obstacle course of paperwork to see if they can get money back so that they can settle down, because some of them, their homes were not going to be rebuilt. They were not in areas that they could be rebuilt. So there are other obstacles that would be traumas. So it's not necessarily always the fires that they go to, or the car wrecks that they go to, or any kind of accidents. It's that time it came home. And so now their families are victims. So that's another whole concern. When you go back to the 9/11 numbers, it's important to remember that they're constantly changing, that there are too frequent deaths. If it's not a plaque dedication today, you know, it's going to be a funeral for a member who passed. We have a plaque dedication today. We had a funeral last week. So that's those numbers are just to me staggering. I think the mental health, though, you know, you're looking at there was one study that was done, and I have to just be sure that I can cite it correctly. Stony Brook, I think, did this study on cognitive impairment, which is like a leading risk factor for Alzheimer's and dementia, and they're finding that. They're finding it in the first responders, and I think the percentage rate that they're finding it to be much greater than the general population, is that they're suffering from health effects. I think it's 20% of the adults who were exposed to the World Trade Center disaster. They have four times the rate of PTS, and that's staggering, because that's exactly where the suicide numbers come in. So with a resistant tribe, as you put it, resistant to counseling, resistant to outside help, it takes a whole nother mindset to say, okay, I'm going to put aside what I've known for 30, 40, 50 years, and I'm going to go and pick up the phone and get the help. That's a tremendously difficult thing to do.
Yeah. And I've talked about this before, but as men specifically, just to pick on our sex for a moment, we were
I'll go right ahead.
we were sold a completely fictitious image or impression of what a man is, you know, the John Waynes. Yeah, the John Waynes of the world. And and the reality was, John Wayne never joined the army or the fire department or anything. He was an actor that, you know, minced around the studio. But we believe that, you know, so then we see this with the entire generation, whether 9/11 happened or, you know, whether you're in a department in the middle of, you know, the west of England somewhere, it's the same thing. And then now we're finally getting these courageous men and women that have really been through, you know, through the grinder in their career, standing up and saying, look, I'm just about to release Jason Gardner, 30-year Navy SEAL, who in the interview is in tears recalling one of his days where he saw a bunch of children killed. And he's like, absolutely, you're supposed to cry. That's a human reaction to this happening. And to suppress that and bury it, as we talked about at the beginning, is just, again, so it works against every grain of the human fiber. But we were led to believe that's what men did. And now we're realizing that's the worst thing you could possibly do, is suppress those feelings.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the thing is that you're really not truly suppressing them. They come out sideways. So that's where anger comes in. And then we do anger management, because you can see that a lot of that is the basis for that is extreme sorrow and depression. And it's got to go somewhere, right? So, you know, if you don't express the feelings that you have and talk about what it is that you saw, and you know, that doesn't normalize it when you talk about it, but what it does is it gets it outside of you. So it's not this loop in your head that is constant. You know, we have firefighters that'll hear a song and it's a trigger. They'll be right back down there at the site. And that could apply to almost any disaster, and maybe almost anyone. But remember how unfamiliar the firefighters are, or had been, to counseling. Now I think it's a lot lot different. You know, the fire department is largely made up of younger firefighters. I got a statistic today. It's 29.3% are still active that were on the job. I was actually surprised it was that high. So they have a different mindset as a different generation, and it's not as taboo. Asking for help is not as taboo as it was back in 2001. But, you know, there's the depression rate is literally five times higher in firefighters than in the civilian population. It is perhaps the most, I think it might be the most stressful job. And I do believe it's up there next to air traffic controller. I know there are stressful jobs, but firefighting is one of the most stressful. And primarily because you could be sitting down, you could even be sleeping, and in within 5 minutes, you're in a shitstorm of fire. Anything can go wrong, and sometimes it does. But when you have there was a NBC did this study. I think they had 7,000 anonymous surveys. And it said that 95% of firefighters experience critical stress. That's 95%. And 77% of those cite unresolved issues. And then over 90% cite stigma as a barrier to seeking behavioral health treatment. So a lot of those, I think it's over 70%, will not go to their department's counseling unit. And those who do, over 50% don't find it helpful. So now this is a study, and I believe it's a nationwide study. So this is not something that is particularly about New York City and FDNY, but those numbers are staggering, I think. And anxiety is one of the most, nationwide. It's anxiety and trauma are the most frequent concerns. So that's something, because if you think about a family member that is feeling so much anxiety, so much trauma, so much trepidation to even walking out the door, much less getting on the rig. And I'll add to that the families who were traumatized through the years. That's a very unhealthy environment to live in. So you mentioned, how do you go out the door? Well, how do you go out the door when that was your constant? That was your comfort. You're maybe not connecting anymore at home, but you don't have the firehouse anymore. So really, it's another tremendous loss. So you lose some friends, family members on 9/11, many. Some guys lost up to 100 friends. There was a gentleman who had his wedding picture, and he was the only survivor of his wedding party. So how do you take that tremendous loss, and then you're losing the job, which is really a lifeline? You mentioned, it shouldn't be the end all for everyone, but there are very, very many firefighters that is their identity. They cannot see outside of being a firefighter. And I worry about them, because they don't have that second interest. One firefighter I knew, he's a nutty guy. I really love this guy. But he was always going on all burners, firefighter, firefighter. And I said, what are you going to do when you retire? And he said, I don't know. And then I saw him after he was retired, and he fell into restoring cars, and he's happy. And a lot of it is that he's focused his energies somewhere. He did go to counseling, but he focused his energies, and he found something that pleases him. And that's important, to have a focus outside of this. So whether if you do leave the job, you have something to go to.
Yeah, no, exactly. Because it's part identity, and it's partly, I remember this feeling over and over again, driving home, knowing that you made a difference in the world. And it's such a powerful feeling. You want to contribute, and now you retire. And even if you are restoring cars, that's incredibly powerful, but you're never going to get that same feeling. But I think that brotherhood and sisterhood, of the tribe that you were in, of the firehouse, if you can continue that, whether it's through, friends of firefighters, whether it's through, retiree parties, finding, new members of a different tribe, but you have to carry that over. And if you just sever all ties, you see this a lot. I'm sure if we had real numbers of depression, anxiety, suicide amongst retirees, they would be staggering.
Yeah. Yeah. And unfortunately, those numbers get a little lost. I think that it's constant sorrow. It's mourning the loss of people people close to you, both through death and through retirement. And it's mourning what was. And you're right. There's a tremendous high that they must get. And I'm speaking from conversations I've had. I certainly am not speaking firsthand. But, you know, there is a sense based on conversations I've had with firefighters that they're proud of what they did as a group. They're proud of what they did individually. But more than anything, they made a difference. They got someone out alive. And yeah, how do you come close to that? Well, the idea is, you know, you don't. You readjust, and you know that's the hard thing is readjusting. How do you readjust and go into a sedate, perhaps, lifestyle? That's something that I really would urge any firefighter that's thinking of leaving, you know, the fire department. If you really consider yourself a firefighter and nothing but a firefighter, you know, there's time to start looking around at other options. And I don't know what they might be because they'd be so vastly different, you know, but important. It's important to have something to go to that's going to give you a sense of purpose. A lot of the firefighters that come and volunteer for us, they're doing it because they want that sense of purpose.
Yeah. And I've had a lot of people on this show from all walks of life that are now doing exactly that, whether they're mentoring recruits for fire, military, whatever it is, or they set up a burn foundation. I mean, you name it, they're just doing incredible things, but they are still driven. They're volunteering their time. They're helping their brothers and sisters. They wake up in the morning with a purpose, and you know, all of them report to that being so powerful for them to retain their mental health. And yes, there's still things that rattle around in there, but they're not just sat in a dark room with a glass of whiskey in their hand ruminating over it because they're busy trying to make the world better still.
Yeah, and unfortunately there are more of the latter because those are the ones that may not be getting the word that there is help and they are sitting in the dark room. You know, there was a woman who was a wife of a firefighter who survived 9/11, and she said to me, she said, "I feel terrible for saying this, but my husband died that day too." And I had to acknowledge to her that, you know, she will not possibly, I didn't say to her, you know, she won't have your husband back. I said, there's help there. And he did end up going into counseling. And it's, I'm very, cautious. I don't know what happens when people go into counseling. I'm not the counselor. So I hope for the best, but for some people they stay and they turn around and they start to volunteer. And then you see a complete change in personalities. I've seen people come in that don't make eye contact. They're shaky. They're nervous. They're angry. They're, you know, any one of those things, but they're not functioning well. And over some time, especially working with these counselors we have, you see a change. And we have one firefighter who was just like that. He was very withdrawn. He didn't make eye contact. You couldn't understand him because he spoke down into his chest. And now he comes in, the door flies open and he's yelling, "Hey!" And it's a beautiful thing to hear. He has come out of his shell. He's feeling more confident. And when you see things like that, it's really a reminder to me, keep going, keep going. Make sure this place is still around because the traumas that these firefighters are having are going to continue and they need a place to go in order to process and get some tools actually to learn how to process the things that they've witnessed because some of them are just inhuman. Some of the things that they see is so horrific that to just take it in and keep it in it's a poison.
Yeah. And one of the reasons why I started this whole project is, and I make this kind of visualization a lot, when you look at a recruit academy, and FDNY is a perfect example because they, you know, their standards are very high, and I know they put those men and women through the grinder as well, literally. And then you fast forward 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, and you look at, you know, the mental health and the physical health of a lot of these men and women. And, you know, in various departments around the world that maybe don't set their standards very high, then that's kind of self-imposed and they let a lot of people through the cracks. But I see this in some of the departments that have, you know, set their bar very high as well. And it's a double-edged sword. Yes, there's ownership of the firefighter, but I think our profession is, I can't think of many other professions where men and women will take a vacation day to then go and do extrication training or ropes training or, you know, whatever it is on their day off, in the paid day off that they've earned. And so these are fired up, you know, people that really love the job. So of those men and women that then find themselves in a dark place mentally, you know, putting on a bunch of weight, being on all these meds, it's educating them for them to understand this job is doing it to you. Now, it shouldn't. There are ways we can improve the shifts, you know, the exposures to the carcinogens, all these areas that are completely in our control. But they beat themselves up. They're like, oh, you know, I can't believe I let my, you know, myself slide. Now I get winded climbing X amount of stairs, whatever it is. And I think it's the same mentally. Like, everyone else is doing fine. I'm just the weak one. And it's educating them to, like, no, everyone is struggling that's been through this. And I can say this because I've had people from Australian SAS and Navy SEALs and British Armed Police Officers. I mean, you name it, all over the globe, and they all report the same thing. If you see horrible things and you work these horrendous shifts, it is going to take its toll on you. Your hormones, I mean, you name it, everything. And I think when they understand that, and that gives them permission to stop beating themselves up, that's when there's a lot of healing as well.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think it's important to get to the firefighters when they're training, when they're in the academy. It's important to talk to them about the mental health aspect of the profession they've chosen, because it used to be, I think, maybe everywhere, and I don't want to isolate any one department, but it used to be you have a bad job, you go out and you get some beers, you know, you go down to the bar, you get some whiskey, and you just drink it away. And I remember being a little girl and seeing a fire in New York City, and the firefighters were outside of the fire and they were laughing and smoking cigarettes. And I thought, why are they laughing? You know, somebody died. And my mother, whose uncle was killed, firefighter, killed line of duty, she said, they're not really laughing. They're coping. And that's how they're coping. You know, look at them smoking. And that was an insightful thing to say, because nobody talked about that stuff back then. You know, it was just, they're coping. They're not laughing at what they just saw. Yeah, you know, they're trying to cope. I think now, there's more of an acceptance that there is no one superhuman, and I'm sure there are still many people that think that they can do it all and not be impacted in any way. But even the strongest ones that I have seen and talked with, you know, they show cracks. They don't think they do, but they show cracks.
Yeah, and it is a facade. And then my thing as well, when you've got people that are doing well, sorry for my dog barking in the back. Neen, shush. When you've got people that are doing well, then I tell them that, well, then you need to go reach out to everyone else and say, here's why I'm doing well right now. Let me be clear first. My family life is great. I'm not going through a divorce. My kids are all healthy. But also, I'm exercising every day. My downtime is I go for a swim, you know, whatever it is, and let these people know that you're in a good place because you've made these choices. And, you know, and tell them as well when you didn't. Tell them that, well, you know what, I drank for a while and it just made things worse. I slept like shit. I woke up feeling, you know, terrible, and I spiraled down for a while until I found X, and then that brought me back up. So I think it's on all of us. The ones that are hurting need to reach out for help, and the ones that are doing well need to look for someone to help and guide them back in.
Yeah, I think so too. But then let's put the reality of life in there, because that's the thing. You know, we're talking about people who are probably working two jobs, have families, juggling a lot of things. This is something that I think everyone needs to look at. Departments across the country have to look at it as a responsibility of educating people, like as they come into the department. But also, I think that let's look at the stressors outside of the job also. A couple of things I just mentioned, where we're living in a very, very, very fast world. What is devastating on Tuesday is forgotten on Friday. It's just the way it is. We're seeing awful news clip after awful news clip. The schools are now targets. There's a whole lot of pressure today that there wasn't 20 years ago, or 40 certainly years ago. And then when you couple that with a job that is this dangerous, and now what 9/11 absolutely did was it brought home to everyone how dangerous this job is. And no one is more aware of it than the spouses and the children of firefighters who now don't want daddy or mommy to go out the door because they might die like Uncle Stephen did. So there is a pressure now on these families who some of them were, you know, as I said, the firefighters traditionally like to keep their families in the dark about what they did and who got hurt. And you know, they didn't even tell their wives if they got burned. And now it's all kind of out there. And that's good and bad. What's good is that they're now availing themselves of help. Not everybody, but many more are getting the help they need. The families hopefully are coming for help as well so that they can cope with it and keep the family intact. But there's still, I think it's a lot to, you know, I've heard firefighters say he's going to talk to this guy, you know, I've known him a long time, I'll talk to him. And then I overhear him say, you know, if you're thinking about killing yourself, I'll punch you in the head. Well, that's not the approach that we were hoping for.
No. Yeah, that's a little counterproductive.
Yeah, so education, I think, is where it starts.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the center. So we've touched on some areas that you're helping. So you mentioned the spouses as well. So you guys have counselors to help the spouses?
Absolutely, yeah. And you're not helping a firefighter if you're not helping the family. So we are available to FDNY firefighters, active and retired, and their family members.
Fantastic.
And it's at no cost. And as I said, we've removed the barriers. There's parking. We have other services, acupuncture, financial guidance. I'm trying to think, the peer workshops. And then we have different educational series. We have a breakfast every month, the second Wednesday of every month. The firefighters cook and other firefighters come in and, you know, there's time to be together and also familiarize themselves with the place. If they hadn't been there before, it demystifies what it is that we do and how we do it. They could be having breakfast and talking to someone for 25 minutes and really like the person and then say, I don't want to come here because I'm not going to sit down with a shrink. And then the person they were talking to says, well, actually, I am the therapist and you've been talking to me for 20 minutes. And that's happened more times than I can count. And that really does demystify the whole thing for them.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, like we said earlier in the interview, you know, that you need that buy-in. Like I was talking to someone earlier today, you know, if someone comes into an FDNY firehouse and they're like, hey, I've done my 2-day YMCA certification. I'm here to teach you fitness. Good luck. They are not going to listen to you whatsoever. But if you are obviously now a well embedded, foundation that you have in a firehouse inhabited by firefighters and you're part of that culture, you are far more likely to get buy-in from the men and women that come in looking for help than you are a regular clinic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. It's, you know, look, it's never going to be easy. It's never easy for anybody to get help. It just isn't. But to know that it's going to be with a group or with a particular person that is sensitive to your needs and your lifestyle, and they understand the language, they understand the schedule. You know, the fire department has a wacky schedule, and it's hard for the families to live by. There's a commitment also. You know, a firefighter wants to see a counselor every Tuesday at 10. Well, that's not their life. You know, they could be doing a mutual. They could be working, their group, they could be working. So we have to be flexible. It's our responsibility to be able to respond to what they need. But they have a responsibility also to show up when they are able to make it. So we haven't had a problem with that. We haven't had a problem with people following through with their therapy once they've committed to going to therapy. I think when they learn it's a finite process, it's a lot easier to go through. If you think you're going to be doing it forever, who wants to do that?
Yeah. Well, exactly. You should have a target. And that's how we work.
Yeah.
You know, this job to be done.
Well, one thing that we're experiencing now is we have a daunting financial situation where we are paying rent for this firehouse and we have to, we have a budget that we have to fill. And we had an event in the fall And unfortunately, it fell on the freak blizzard evening, and we made less than a quarter of what we usually make. So we're scrambling, and we're doing everything that we can. And the firefighters themselves have been very generous in donating what they can and when they can. But my fear is that we're going to have to close. And that is, to me, unconscionable, because in my mind, every large city should have a Friends of Firefighters. And maybe not us, obviously, but they should have some form of help on in the way that the firefighters can get it, meaning preferably in an old firehouse, preferably run by firefighters, but with the, I want to say supervision, because I do think we learn more from the firefighters than anything, but certainly with the involvement of licensed clinicians to be able to look at a situation and know when it's a crisis, know when there's a threat there of real danger. And I think that that's really important to have. So I would love to see Friends of Firefighters in the larger cities. We have been asked by different cities if we can expand there. And right now, I don't feel we're financially secure enough where we are so that I could do that.
So apart from the ice storm, what's changed? Is it every year you get further from 9/11, it gets harder and harder, or?
You know what's hard? What's hard is separating us from 9/11, because that is absolutely the impetus that started Friends of Firefighters. And we wouldn't exist if it weren't for that disaster. It's just, there wouldn't have been a need at the time to start it. However, I've met firefighters that were fighting in the 50s and 60s and 70s who said, I wish this was around when I was on the job. So maybe it has always been needed, but it started as a result of 9/11, and therefore we're inextricably linked to 9/11. And I think that people actually have said to me, 9/11 was so long ago, why should we be involved? Why should we support you? And really, I want to pull them away from that particular day and say, let's look at the job as it stands. Without any particular event. But if you want to talk about events, we've got crisis. We've had many fatal fires since 9/11 and repeated traumas. So I can go in with a long laundry list of it, but I just feel that that detracts from what our mission is. What our mission is to be there to provide the help to the firefighters and basically on their terms, which we have done. And so, yeah, it's been difficult to get support. And I think another thing is some people say, well, they have counseling services units, so isn't this redundant? No, redundancy in counseling, I actually don't know that that's possible. If a firefighter or anyone in the world is seeing two therapists, that would confuse the hell out of the person first, and then, of course, the therapist. So it's not like a double dip kind of thing. What it is, we're catching those firefighters and those family members who will not go for counseling through their job. And I don't know that they would seek out counseling on their own. So we're able to catch the ones that would fall through the cracks. And that's what our purpose is. And that's what our success has been, that we're able to catch those firefighters that perhaps did go to the job for counseling. And for whatever reason, it didn't work out. It could simply be chemistry. You know, it's not for me to judge why it didn't work out. But if it didn't work out, shouldn't they have another opportunity?
Yeah. I know what I can say from my perspective in California and Florida, we are far from having an efficient and well-versed mental health system in our profession. So I'm pretty sure that, you know, what the alternative to you is not, you know, encompassing all of them anyway. So there's definitely a need for you as well.
Yeah. And again, you know, our being outside of the department, and by the way, we are recognized by the department. We are vetted by them. We actually have the right to use their logo. So they understand that what we do is legitimate. We have an excellent record. And the support of the unions, frankly, I'm married to a union president. So unions are important to me. I was raised in a union household. So the fact that the unions support us is very important to me. It's like the good housekeeping seal. That doesn't get us the grant monies that we need to operate. It doesn't make it easier for us to raise money, because while they do, the unions, particularly the UFA and the UFOA, do support us through our functions. They will sponsor our functions. And we have been invited to their delegates seminars twice a year. Actually, not twice a year. They each have it once a year, and we go to both of them. the international understands what we're doing. And in fact, the international started their own counseling center that is very familiar as it's the same type of model as to what we're doing. So, you know, knowing that what we're doing is supported by the fire department, the unions, and the members themselves, well, with that, you know, comes the responsibility to make sure that we continue. And, you know, especially helping the firefighters. We have about 100 firefighters currently in treatment, and we're not going to have them drop at the end of, you know, and I don't mean 100 firefighters, 100 people, so spouses and family members. We're not going to abandon them. But there is a very daunting task of raising the funds.
Yeah. So how can people listening help?
Oh, my goodness. Go to our website, www.friendsoffirefighters.org, and it's all right there. There are many different ways that, that people can help. It's from having a monthly donation or just a one-time donation or being involved, buying merchandise. The firefighters in the city can pay through, they can have a portion go through New York City Gives on their payroll, which a lot of firefighters are starting to do, which is wonderful. And supporting our events, we have several during the year, and they can go to our website and see what's happening. We're also on Instagram and Facebook, and there's a lot of information on there and some great videos of the firefighters talking about what it is we do and how we do it.
Fantastic. Yeah, it seems like the residents of New York should, you know, I wish there was a way of reinvigorating them to see what those men and women do for them every single day. And, you know, certainly what they did back then as well, and make them realize that it's our responsibility now to help the men and women that helped them back then.
Yeah, because they continue to help. You know, I go to sleep at night in the city knowing that if anything happens, they'll come through and get my sorry ass out of there. So I think that it's important for us to remember that they too can need help. And I know everyone's busy. I know everybody's got their very busy lives. And I'm glad if they have never had a fire. I'm glad that if they've never experienced anything like that. But I would be very surprised if there was one person in New York City that hasn't felt anxious or scared or depressed at any given time. And when you apply that to the firefighters and what it is that they do, there must be some empathy there that says, you know, I want to help in some way or another. So, yeah, I mean, even volunteering is a big help to us.
Brilliant. All right. Well, I want to just talk a moment about a couple of your board members, because I've had some people from the entertainment industry on here, and the reason they're on here is nothing to do with their fame. It's because they're good people. And, you know, I wouldn't say it's rare amongst that. I don't know what the backstory of a lot of actors are, but it's nice to see that. So, and you have Gary Sinise and Steve Buscemi, FDNY fireman, on there. So if you wouldn't mind just telling us a little bit about, you know, what they do with you guys.
Well, you know, I swear, those two are walking saints. Those two have no celebrity affectations. They really are real people. Gary, I met, gosh, almost 10 years ago at the Brooklyn Wall, and he immediately took to what it is that we're doing, and he was growing his foundation at the time. He was doing different things to help first responders, in particular military, and we became friends. And I asked him to be on the board a number of years ago, and he very quickly said yes. And he wrote a book recently, and he had it released at our firehouse because he wanted to bring attention to what it is that we do. And he raised quite a bit of money for us in doing that. And he just has a beautiful way of understanding the human condition and not passing judgment, actually helping, truly helping. And so he has been an honor to know. He's such a good man. And then Steve is actually a neighbor. He lived very close to where I used to live. And we became friends because Steve was a firefighter in New York City. He was at 55 Engine. So he understood the mission, but ironically, it was his wife that was kind of pushing him. She said, you know, you walked away from the fire department to do what you do, but I think they need you. And unfortunately, we lost her in January. Joe passed away from cancer. And Steve just did an event for us last week where he came, and he's currently in television, a series on TBS called The Miracle Worker, and he plays God. And he had the last segment of the show was aired at our old firehouse, and we had a meal prior to, and he had a Q&A with Anatole Youssef, who played Meyer Lansky in Boardwalk Empire, and he's also a dear friend of Friends of Firefighters, and it was beautiful. The Steve constantly goes to things with me. He promotes Friends of Firefighters. He supports Friends of Firefighters. But there's a point to the expectation that you have of any that one, certainly a celebrity that has agreed to join your board. He and Gary cannot come in on white horses and shining armor and turn it all around, but they certainly are giving their comfort level to make it possible for us to turn it around ourselves. And that's what they've been doing. They both give to us. I don't want to say that they don't, but they're not going to be the ones that are going to be able to give us our budget every year, if that makes sense. So what Steve does, he comes with me to Cantor Fitzgerald Charity Day every year, and BTG, and it's a trading floor, and they give a portion of their commissions to charities and on that day. And it's usually on 9/11, which makes it tough for both Steve and me because we have many, many places to be on 9/11. But Cantor Fitzgerald generously allows us to come to them. And then they distribute monies to different charities. So we've been doing that for a number of years. And Steve, when I met Steve initially, he said, well, I only do this once and I change charities every year. And that was, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. And we are his charity now. So he just goes for us. So we're very lucky to have both of them.
Yeah. And I'm sorry to hear about his wife too. That's awful.
Oh, she was a doll. Just a doll.
All right. Well, I just want to just transition to some closing questions, because we've been going over an hour now, and I'd love to just get your thoughts on some of these questions that I ask.
Okay.
Is there a book that you love to recommend to people? It can be about what we've talked about today or something completely different.
Oh, you know what? There is a book that I went out and bought 30 copies of because it was going out of print and they were just basically dumping them. And I don't have a copy left of it. I forgot to keep one for myself. But it was a paperback reissue of a book that was written in the 1800s about the New York City Fire Department, right down to what the supplies were. And it was not there's a famous one about the firefighters. And I have to get back to you with the title of it because I've been looking for it for about 10 years and I haven't read it since. I think what I would say is there are two books. Gary Sinise's book is number one. And I'm not saying that because I want to toot his horn because he's on our board. It's beautifully written. It's humble. And his life story is a surprise. You really wouldn't look at him and say, oh, you were a terrible student. But he was a terrible student. He was a real screw up. And the way he tells the story about what he does and how he does it is beautiful. How many people can write about helping so many members, both of the military and the fire and police departments, and not come off as a blowhard? Well, he does that because he isn't anything less than altruistic. So I definitely would recommend Gary's book. And then the other is, let me think, that's a good one. That's a good one. I think the other one is really, if you have a lot of firefighters that listen to your podcast, I would say Vinnie Dunn's, any one of Vinnie Dunn's books, but he just rewrote another one that he did on collapse that he's very proud of. And Vinnie Dunn is the final word on collapse and New York City fire. So Chief Dunn, I think his book is either out or coming out, and I would recommend that. I got to see a little bit of it prior to.
Excellent. Well, thank you. So the next question is the same kind of question, but mm-hmm. Favorite movie and or documentary?
Oh boy, I might have to get back to you on that. Favorite movie or documentary? I have to get back to you on that. I don't see enough movies.
No, honestly, it's fine. No problem at all.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm drawing a blank right there. I'm going to have to ask my husband to help me with that one because he always... I'm the person that used to go to the video store and buy the same damn movie I got 2 weeks before because I forgot we saw it. So I'm really not good with that. I forget titles.
No problem at all. All right. So then the next one, which is an interesting one, is there a person that you would recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to talk to the first responders of the world?
Vinnie Dunn.
Vinnie Dunn. Okay.
Vinnie Dunn in a heartbeat. He is brilliant and he is... I think he's so informative and it's a fact that he has saved lives through his knowledge. He was at the 23rd Street fire where there was a terrazzo floor that collapsed and he lost many friends and members of the department. And his way of processing his grief was to write books and learn everything he could about collapse. And he has, as a result, I'm sure they've changed codes because of him, the building codes. So I'm sure he has saved lives. Vinnie Dunn would be most informative. And I think if you want to get an inside view of FDNY and operations today, I would recommend Rescue 2 Captain Liam Flaherty.
All right. I'm just writing that down now. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. All right. So sure. Then the last one before we go, make sure we go over, you know, where people can find you and how they can donate. What do you do to decompress when you're not at the firehouse helping my peers?
I restore classic cars.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I build cars.
Very cool.
Yes, that really is my love. My first love is that. And of course, I have kids, so they have to come first. But I've been fortunate enough to find a garage that took the time and taught me and... now I just found an old car that we just restored and I actually have it outside. I got to go put it away. And that's what I do to decompress.
Very cool. All right. I've heard that from about two or three other guests, but yeah, everyone has their thing. But I would find trying to restore a car incredibly stressful because I'm not mechanically inclined. So.
What do you do?
I'm more of a kind of go into nature kind of a guy, play with my dog. So that way.
No, those are all good things too. It's just that if I really, really, really feel stressed, I want to see something tangible at the end of doing something to release it. And for me, the ability to turn the car over and have it start is wonderful. Yes, there are frustrations, absolutely. But the cars, and also I sing, and so I love doing that. That's also a stress reliever for me.
Fantastic. Yeah. All right. So one more time, let's just talk about where we can find you online, how people can donate, and if they want to reach out to you, what is the best method?
First of all, if you go to www.friendsoffirefighters.org, that's our website. We're on Facebook. We're also on Instagram. If they want to reach the office, it's 718-643-0980. You can say hi to Marlo or Sylvie. And they'll answer any questions. And also, email info@friendsoffirefighters.org.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, I want to say thank you so much. This has been a great conversation. You know, what you did, you know, with your team members there to get this going and what you're doing for the profession that I love is, you know, admirable. And I hope that this is going to help raise some of the funds that you need after that ice storm.
Thank you so much. I hope so too, but I do have to interject that it's actually been an honor. I don't see it as an admirable act on my part. I see it as an honor and a privilege.